Welcome to another edition of Truth Jihad Radio, where you sometimes get to hear almost the entire song right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett, bringing on the most interesting guests with the most important and unusual perspectives that you'll never hear in the mainstream media. Today we're going to talk to a couple of my many heroes. All my guests are pretty much my heroes. That's why I bring them on, is to pay tribute to what they've been able to accomplish. And my guests today have all accomplished quite a bit. We have basically two and a half guests today because my third guest, I'm not sure if he's going to make it or not. I haven't been able to contact him in the last couple of days, but we'll see. First, our guest will be Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. Apparently, the cops in many American cities think that Food Not Bombs is the most dangerous terrorist group on earth. Judging by the way they treat these folks when they go out in public places and try to serve food to hungry people, the cops are apparently, they've got some very strange ideas about just, you know, what subversive activity is and, you know, how serving food in public can undermine the social order. Then, after Keith's on, we'll bring on Steve Alton, the author of The Shell Game. Steve is a very brave man. He had a lucrative career writing fictional stories, mainly about monsters and dinosaurs and so on, running amok. And when he decided to sit down and write a 9/11 truth novel, he was taking a whole new direction and taking a big risk with his career. And his book, The Shell Game, has done okay. But, you know, he's a little frustrated that the 9/11 truth movement didn't unite behind it quite as well as they might have. And I know how he feels. That's sometimes how I feel about my own political campaign at barrettforcongress.us. So anyway, that should be an interesting conversation with Steve. And after Steve, we may or may not be able to bring on Dr. Faiz Khan. He is the seminal American Muslim 9/11 truth activist. He was out there pushing 9/11 truth from not too long after it happened. He was actually a first responder. He treated the victims, did triage on 9/11 victims on that day. He was a New York City physician at that point. And he then became the best-known Muslim American 9/11 truth activist, and he helped convince me to become the next big Muslim 9/11 truth activist. And together we founded the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth, which I'm happy to say has now been taken over by the Christians. It's in the hands of Lou Stoltenberg. I believe she's a Methodist, a very nice woman. And frankly, the Christians winning control of Mujkanet is actually a very good thing. Anyway, we're going to try and bring on Faiz in the second hour, but I'm not 100% sure he's going to be able to make it. So we'll keep our proverbial fingers crossed. But again, we will be starting out with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs. I don't have my screen in front of me again today, so I'm going to have to play it by ear, as it were, and hear the cues in my earpiece to who's online and who isn't. I don't know if we've gotten a hold of Keith yet, but let's try and find out. Food Not Bombs, of course, as I said, is an amazing organization that's just gone viral all over the world, feeding hungry people in public, and just having the name Food Not Bombs makes it a powerful political statement. It apparently threatens the powers that be because they just crack down on it. And you know, in the Twin Cities at the Republican National Convention, once again, they were after people that they thought might be connected to Food Not Bombs. What is it about serving food in public and advocating food over bombs that so threatens the status quo? Well, maybe Keith will be able to fill us in. Hey, Keith, are you there yet? Hello, Keith McHenry? Well, it looks like we haven't got him online, so we're going to keep trying to reach him. But yeah, let me tell you a little bit about how I first encountered the work of Food Not Bombs. It was quite a while ago. I was living in San Francisco. This would have been, the 1980s and 90s, early 90s. And Food Not Bombs was just kind of getting going somewhere in there. They were very active in San Francisco. They were feeding homeless people and hungry people. And they were managing to get a pretty angry reaction from the police, which I never really understood this. But I guess the legal angle is that they need permits to serve food in public, even if it's free. So maybe the restaurant lobby or something doesn't want competition. They're certainly undercutting prices. But there's also something I think about the message of food over bombs that that terrifies people because it reminds us of how insane we all are. We're spending this kind of money on the military. You know, the United States of America is spending more money on the military than all the other significant military powers on Earth combined, and yet we have a nation with borders. To the north is Canada, which is hardly ready to stage a new war of 1812 against us, and to the south, Mexico, where the only kind of invasion we face is from poor people hoping to contribute to our productive economy. So it just doesn't really make any sense that we're spending all that money on defense. Well, of course we aren't. We're spending it on offense. And we're going over and trying to take over the world on behalf of the New World Order, which does strike me as a rather questionable project. You know, we really need to have our kids dying overseas for the international bankers so they can cement their worldwide financial empire. I don't know. I don't see why any Americans would go along with that if they knew that's what was happening. So going out and talking about food over bombs, which is, of course, resonates with the old guns over butter debate, is a good way to provoke people to thinking about these things, and perhaps it threatens them because it makes them realize just how our priorities are so far out of whack. The reality is so different from the way we see ourselves, just like 9/11 truth threatens people in that same way by threatening to pull the curtain and reveal the little man back there and show us exactly who we really are, what kind of a country we are, what kind of people are running our country, what kind of heroic sacrifices we've been doing for these great military crusades down through the years. Truth is sometimes a pretty tough thing, and I think Food Not Bombs is contributing to spreading truth. Let's see if we have Keith on the line yet. Keith McHenry, are you there yet? Hello, Keith. Oh, we're not having any luck yet with Keith. Okay, we're still. I got word from the control booth that we're still trying to pull Keith up. In the meantime, I guess I can maybe give you a little breaking story about the Barrett for Congress campaign. Forging ahead, we did win the primary election here in Wisconsin on Tuesday. This is, as far as I know, only the third victory for a 9/11 Truth candidate running for federal office. The first two were Cynthia McKinney in 2004, and Bob Bowman, I believe, won a Democratic primary in 2006 when he was running for Congress in Florida. So we have two earlier congressional victories for 9/11 Truth candidates, two of my heroes, Cynthia McKinney, who's now the Green Party candidate for president, and Bob Bowman, the former head of the Star Wars Space Weapons Program and a fighter pilot with 100 missions under his belt, who's not afraid to say that the government's story of 9/11 is hogwash and that we desperately need a new investigation. He nearly won. He not only won the Democratic primary, but he ended up getting 44% on Diebold machines. Some people say that's probably winning. And Bob says the exit polls actually had him winning a landslide victory. So he gave up, discouraged by this voting machine problem. And now this year, I'm carrying on the tradition around with along with other folks like Carol Brule out in the Bay Area. What other 9/11 Truth candidates do we still have in the running at this point? I know there were some ones earlier, like Leland Lehrman in New Mexico, who dropped out. I believe Lori Dobson is running in Maine, picked for Senate. And I haven't heard exactly where her candidacy is. So I don't think she's actually won any competitive elections up there, but I would love to hear differently. If anybody knows of any other 9/11 Truth candidates who've actually won something, please call in and tell me about it. The number here is, well, it's on your computer screen, I'm sure, but I can also tell you that it is 512-646-1984. 512-646-1984. Well, you don't have to call in to save me from this interminable monologue, because we did get a hold of our first guest, Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, the totally threatening, subversive, revolutionary group that needs to be attacked and beaten up and smashed preemptively disrupted by the police, because they are out there serving food in public, calling themselves Food Not Bombs, and thereby threatening to bring down Western civilization. Hey, it's an honor to welcome the brains behind that operation, or one of the brains, the originator of the idea, I believe, Keith McHenry. Welcome, Keith.
Thank you so much for having us. It's fantastic.
Oh, it's always good to have you on, Keith. You really came up with a brilliant idea when you founded Food Not Bombs, and it went viral, and now the police all over the world are trembling in their jackboots. How'd you do it?
Apparently so, yeah. Basically, we came up with a simple idea which that could be reproduced by young people without much resources at all, and that's basically collect discarded organic food from grocery stores, farmers, farmers markets, bakeries, and make it into vegetarian and vegan meals that we serve on the streets with literature about peace and social justice issues. And that actually went along fine for the first 8 years in Boston and Cambridge and around in New England. But then when we started serving food in San Francisco, to our surprise, we ended up getting attacked by the police. So on August 15th of 1988, 45 riot police emerged from the Golden Gate Park and arrested nine of us, and that became the start of a campaign that resulted in over 1,000 arrests in San Francisco. And by 88, we were declared one of America's most hardcore terrorist groups by the FBI and the Pentagon, and repression against us has grown and grown since that time.
You know, I used to live in San Francisco, Keith, and I'm ashamed of the way that the this city of supposed tolerance and progressive values and, you know, psychedelic openness and free thinking and the free spirit couldn't handle Food Not Bombs. Do you understand this paradox? How could you get away with it on the East Coast and not in San Francisco?
I know. For me, it seemed like Boston was considered a conservative, stodgy town, and my parents, or my mom and grandparents, had lived there for many generations. But
where
then I thought,
banned,
well, yes, San Francisco would be this great liberal place, and it would be fantastic. And so I wrote a little letter to the Recreation and Parks Department asking for the same kind of permit I had in Boston. And instead of sending a permit, they sent out these riot police, and they were very, very organized, and they spent millions of dollars. They actually separated out the budget. At one point, they had a budget item about how much they were spending on attacking food, not bombs, but they had to eliminate it because it was becoming embarrassing. And their campaign lasted from 88 to 97. In the course of that, I ended up in 94 when the California three strikes law came into being charged with all three strikes and faced 25 years to life in prison. And it wasn't until Amnesty International, the United Nations Human Rights Commission, and thousands and thousands of volunteers around the world organized protests and events, and they were able to get the government to back down. Otherwise, I would be not able to talk to you today, and I'd be in prison at this time.
It's really mind-boggling that serving food and some peace literature along with it can so threaten the status quo, especially the SFPD. I guess that's a sign that you're doing something right.
That's absolutely what we think, is that basically, and it seems to be we're growing so fast. We have over 1,000 chapters in the world. We have roughly 60 groups in 60 different cities of Russia serving free food. We have this summer.
You're going to have to wait till after the break for the complete list.
Okay, great.
We'll pick that up. Pick it up where we left off in a moment. This is Kevin Barrett with Keith McHenry. Stay tuned.
You're listening to We the People Radio Network. Pure energy. Pure energy. We the People Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is the Truth Jihad Radio Show right here on We the People Radio.
Great.
Today I'm talking with Keith McHenry of Food Not Bomb, one of the most terroristic, subversive groups out there, at least according to certain law enforcement authorities, because they have the temerity, the gall, nay, the unmitigated audacity to dish out free food in public, and along with some peace literature. Terrible, terrible thing. Well, Keith, I hear that you were involved in trying to bail out a whole bunch of Food Not Bombs people that were victimized by this kind of preemptive police aggression in the Twin Cities outside the Republican convention.
Yeah, we were that 2 weeks of the Democratic and Republican convention was really insane. And first, the largest cases that happened at the Democratic convention turned out to be Food Not Bombs volunteers from Pioneer Valley in western Massachusetts were accused of stockpiling feces to use against the delegates. It turned out that they were drinking some coffee with soy milk, but they were, like, thrown violently to the ground by a SWAT team and arrested and their car seized, and quite a crazy situation. And I was at that event, and it was very intense how the riot police, like 40 riot police, and looked like Darth Vader's would march through our kitchen and in Civic Center Park and stuff. But then
they were probably going to seize the food and claim that
it was very frightening and bizarre. And they would brush up against us with their batons and stuff. And I watched there was a number of officers that dressed up in Obama T-shirts with black bandanas on their heads, and they had a backpack with rocks, and I watched them provoke the riot police to pepper spray everybody, and 100 people were arrested, and it was pretty outrageous. But then on Wednesday, our office in Berkeley was raided by the FBI, and 13 computers seized, and all of our equipment, was captured by the FBI then. But then the most frightening thing was the day before the Republican National Convention, riot police and SWAT teams with the FBI broke through the windows and doors of three of our houses in Minneapolis, held our people at gunpoint on the floor, and ransacked the houses, seizing all of our equipment, and claimed that because they had infiltrated our organization 12 months earlier, where two of their FBI agents had proposed that we kidnap delegates and so on, that they then were justified in breaking down our doors and taking our people and seizing our buildings. And so we now have eight people that are facing conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism, and they're the first eight people to be charged under the Patriot Act for this crime, and they're facing 70 years in prison. So we've been, like, very concerned that more of such raids would happen, more people arrested, and even greater clampdown. This summer, two of our volunteers were convicted in an FBI frame-up. One, Eric McDavid, is now doing 19 years in prison after a woman named Anna, who original name was Sarah, had been paid $75,000 by the Sacramento, California FBI field office to join Food Not Bombs and to see what she could scare up. They gave her blasting caps. The FBI gave her blasting caps, a manual on how to build a bomb, plans on how to bomb a dam outside of Sacramento, provided her with a car that was wired, like an old car that looked beat up but was actually souped up and wired, and a house that was completely under video and audio surveillance. And unfortunately, our two volunteers, Ren and Eric, didn't heed the warnings to get away from this woman, and just merely because of the fact that while they argued against her ideas, that they remained friends, they ended up getting convicted. And this has been a widespread problem in the Food Not Bombs movement in the last few years, where we now have a little over 20 volunteers that are facing decades in prison, that are doing decades in prison because of FBI informants and FBI agents who are doing crimes and then charging them on us.
That's a complete outrage. It sounds like the same modus operandi that they used with, for example, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, where the FBI informant actually taped himself talking with his FBI handler about the fact that the FBI had built the bomb.
Yes, so that's exactly. And the Kunstler, when Kunstler took the case, they were able to expose in federal court that the entire crime was created by the FBI. And we have now many young people that are doing long prison sentences for crimes that they in no way were involved in, but that the FBI created in our behalf. So
you know,
people can learn more about
FBI to prison.
foodnotbombs.net, foodnotbombs.net/spy.html. I have links to many of the internal FBI memos that talk about how they infiltrated our movement. They were able to disrupt our national gathering in New York during the Republican National Convention by planting FBI agents in the Richmond and New York City Food Not Bombs chapters, which then argued with each other while our members were unaware of the fact that the volunteers, that their volunteers were actually FBI agents trying to keep us from having a successful Food Not Bombs gathering. So it's pretty astounding.
I
hope people come to foodnotbombs.net and foodnotbombs.net/spy.html and find out really about the clampdown that's happening to this nonviolent peace organization in a coordinated national campaign by Pentagon, FBI, CIA, and others. It's just a really outrageous.
Well, you're obviously pushing some buttons somewhere. We do have a caller. I didn't get the name, but the caller's from Ohio. Caller, come in and identify yourself. Hello, caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air. This can be another of those slow days. Hello, caller from Ohio. You. Hello. Yeah, well, maybe we'll...
No, anyway. Yeah, I mean, we do have, like, or the caller from Ohio. There are chapters in all the major cities of Ohio. And one of the things that I've been doing to talk about the issue of Punah bombs and to encourage people to, because it is a nonviolent group, and really what we are doing is collecting food and serving it on the streets in 1,000 cities of the world. I've been speaking at colleges, and I intend to speak at Oberlin.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah. Oh, hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Rick in Ohio. And
hey, Rick.
I'd just like to say I want to support you and keep you in our prayers. And I'd like to say that, I'll tell you what, it's times are tough, and I've got to keep a vigilant watch on what's going on.
Well, thanks, Rick.
Thank you so much. One of the things that Americans are unaware of is in 1994-95, I was captured a number of times by the police intelligence unit of the San Francisco Police Department, taken to police intelligence office at room 135 at the police headquarters, stripped naked and lifted by my arms and legs repeatedly by six or seven officers who ripped my tendons and ligaments. And once you could hear them rip, they ended up putting me in a small metal cage hanging from the ceiling, which they called K-cell. It was so small I couldn't stretch back out. I stayed there in the freezing cold for 4 days naked, and this was very, very damaging. And since getting out in the years since then, you know, with Abu Ghraib and all of that, I've come to learn that this is a common technique. One of the officers involved had been CIA named Tom Girard, and worked in El Salvador. And they call it the Tiger Cage in Vietnam era. And you could read about this cage in a number of books, including Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein. And
okay, you know, we're actually at the end. We're at
the public to into.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Truth Jihad Radio Show. I'm Kevin Barrett. Sorry that Keith McHenry had to leave so quickly in the middle of recounting that horrendous story of the abuse he suffered at the hands of certain intelligence agency-related people in the San Francisco Police Department. I actually got beat up by the SFPD myself once for absolutely no good reason. So I feel for Keith, and I really support his work. And if you want to support his work, you can go to foodnotbombs.net, foodnotbombs.net, and check out just why is it so incredibly subversive to be handing out free food and peace literature in public places. My next guest, like Keith, has discovered that all is not as it seems in the military intelligence police sector of our nation, that there's some ugly creatures hiding under the rocks. And he was so shocked when he found out, he decided to change his literary career a little bit. And instead of writing best-selling novels generally about dinosaurs, monsters, and other similar topics, he wrote a 9/11 truth novel, the best-selling 9/11 truth novel yet, The Shell Game. It sold over 30,000 copies. It has awakened a number of people to the possibility that 9/11 wasn't what they thought it was, including some people in my own family. And the author, Steve Alton, has really put his career on the line. He's gone all out. He has been working with the 9/11 Truth Movement to help get that book out there and change history. And I salute his courage, and I'm always happy to have him on. So welcome, Steve Alton. How are you?
Good, Kevin, and congratulations to you on your success as an up-and-coming politician.
Well, yeah, I don't know if I like being called that, Steve, but I think
that's kind of a nasty way to put it, but let me rephrase that as somebody who not only walks the walk, talks the talk, puts himself out on the line for what he believes in, and I support that. So,
well, thanks. I support you're doing that, too. It's pretty much the same thing we're all trying to do. Getting the truth out about the way things really are. It's 9/11 is sort of the ultimate brief commercial for it, but of course it goes deeper than that and involves the kind of brutality and corruption and really evil in high places that we really need to address as quickly and forcefully as possible.
So, well, it's interesting because this week I'm doing some research for my next book, called The Grim Reaper, and it's it deals with evil, obviously, and I'm reading some new studies that are done about psychopaths, and it seems that many people in the Bush administration, including our glorious leader George W. Bush, fall under the definition of what a psychopath is. And,
I agree completely. Did you catch my essay, Twilight of the Psychopaths?
No, I missed that.
Yeah, just Google Twilight Psychopaths and my name, and I think it's been posted more than 125,000 places. It's probably the most read thing I've ever written thus far. I agree with you, Steve. I think that diagnosis of people in high places as psychopaths has a lot to do with you know, these kinds of contagions of political evil that we're suffering, that Nazi Germany suffered, that Stalinist Russia suffered. And do you think that this kind of political diagnosis holds hope for changing things?
Well, it seems that, at least according to these studies that I'm reading, that the population is, it seems that common sense gets tossed out the window when it comes down to dealing with these people, and that, you know, backed by, in this case, the fear card played on 9/11, we suddenly stop questioning things, and it certainly fits the bill as far as the definition. All the things that happened post 9/11, whether it was with the Patriot Act or allowing Bush and Cheney to testify not under oath, not in front of all the committee members of the 9/11 investigation, which was a joke in itself, and just no notes were taken, and you know how these people get away with these things. It falls under the emperor has no clothes scenario, you know, where people, the population is just marching in step with this, even though from an individual standpoint, you know that the emperor has no clothes, but you're just going along with it. And I think, you know, for the last 7 years, we've sort of fallen prey to that.
Well, yeah,
but not everybody.
Yeah, the world as a whole hasn't fallen for it. I don't know if you caught that latest global poll showing that. I think they looked at 17 nations, and they found that I think in 9 of those nations, the majority thought that Al Qaeda was responsible for 9/11, and in 8 of them, the majority thought otherwise. So, as the headline said, something like the world is divided about who really did 9/11.
Well, you hope that at some point it will break into the mainstream and be accepted, and the pendulum will swing back the other way. And I think that slowly and surely it is. But, you know, you have to continue to get the word out, and that's what your show does, and that's what the shell game does to a certain extent.
Oh, yeah, the shell game does it real well. I know my brother really enjoyed that more than any other 9/11 truth book I've tried to voice on it. Yeah, it's a good read. It's a page-turner. We should still be pushing it. I know that you were a little bit frustrated that the 9/11 truth movement didn't unite behind it as forcefully as they should have. Can you tell me a little bit about that process?
Well, first, when I wrote the book, it was I had no idea that the 9/11 truth movement existed, so I didn't really write it for the 9/11 truth movement. I wrote it because I felt that it would make a good venue to tell a cautionary tale and to reveal the things that happened in 9/11 and to name names and name events and just put it all out there. It wasn't until after the book was written, right before the book came out, that I became aware about the different 9/11 truth movements. And we sent out, my publicist and I contacted them and sent out advanced reading copies to the group's movement leaders and hoping to generate interest in, amongst their groups. And to a certain extent we did, but what was frustrating, especially in an event called the Week of Truth that came out, I think, last May, I believe it was, where we tried to get the book up on top of the New York Times bestseller list to generate mainstream publicity on shows like Letterman and Leno and the Today Show, shows that you really have to be up on top to get on with this type of subject matter and sort of come in the back door. And what was disappointing is that there was so much bickering among the 9/11 truth groups as to, you know, their own personal feelings about what was in the book, 90% of them having never read the book. And so what they took was rhetoric on blogs and made it their own truth, which is very disappointing considering that that's exactly what the 9/11 truth movement is against, rhetoric, as opposed to looking into the truth itself, because everything we've been said about 9/11 is rhetoric and falsehoods. And so they, you know, the people in the 9/11 movement, truth movement, who read the shell game really backed it. And the others all had commentary that had nothing to do with the book. You know, well, he doesn't mention anything about Israel. Well, you know, he doesn't come out and state that George Bush actually did it, which is not true. You know, and it just went on and on and on. And so when it came time to everyone generating enthusiasm during the Week of Truth for buying the book and spreading the word about it, you know, 50 or 60% of the groups sort of petered out about it, which was, I really think, was a missed opportunity. And in addition to that, I've had threatening calls in the middle of the night from members of the 9/11 truth movement who start playing me recordings of George Bush and stating, well, how could you allow him to get away with this, and how could you allow him to get away with that? And my response is, and they don't want to talk to me. They just want to play me recordings. And so I'm wondering, why am I being harassed by the 9/11 truth movement when the fact is that the shell game is one of the best tools for the movement?
Of course. Are you sure that these people calling in the middle of the night playing tape recordings are bona fide members?
Well, there's no way of telling. They could be, you know, plants, and they could be who knows what. You know, yeah. Either way, it doesn't affect me, but...
Right, right. Well, I feel for you. I have some of the same problems. I'll talk about it when we come back after the break. This is Kevin Barrett talking with Steve Alton, the author of The Shell Game, a great 9/11 truth bestseller. Hand it to your friends who aren't hip to 9/11 yet. We'll be back in a moment. Stick around. Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett. I'm on here at WTTRN.com every Saturday and Sunday from 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time, same channel. And today I'm talking with Steve Alton, the author of The Shell Game. He's a New York Times best-selling author, and The Shell Game is the best-selling of the several 9/11 truth novels out there. And before the break, Steve, you were just saying that you were annoyed, and understandably so, by some of the reactions that your novel got within the 9/11 truth movement, people who criticized it, sometimes adamantly, without even reading it, thereby deflating some of the momentum that was building, and even some crazies calling you in the middle of the night playing tape recordings. as a movement, we should be able to do better than that in terms of uniting for productive purposes. And, you know, I've also felt this way. For instance, the very day I announced for Congress, I was banned from 911blogger.com, ostensibly because that I had a radio show with another guy, Jim Fetzer, who has somewhat different opinions than I do about what probably happened on 9/11. And because he has these different opinions, some people attack him. They think something else probably happened. And because I have the same radio show with him, that makes me hard by association with him. So they got me banned from the most most widely viewed 9/11 truther website the very day I announced for Congress, thereby massively undercutting my congressional campaign. And you know, this is just one example of a long list of problems that have arisen as I've had some successes doing things. I don't know if it's jealousy or what that leads people to try to mess with you when you're in a position to actually do something successful. But I think that's definitely what was happening with the shell game. I mean, that's a really big thing when you have a New York Times best-selling author publishing a 9/11 truth novel and pushing it towards the bestseller list. And it's almost as if there's some kind of a self-destructive impulse that within some of these so-called 9/11 truth people that stops them from actually trying to help anything that could be effective.
Well, I totally agree. And it's just utter nonsense because in the best scenario, these 9/11 groups are working together with one voice, and it's the one voice that gets heard. But because there's no unity amongst these groups, because they're so worried about which one is the most right, it stops the potential for the group's power. You know, everyone who's associated with any type of 9/11 truth movement or questions what the Bush administration says, which there certainly is plenty of reason to question it, should be calling for a new 9/11 investigation with subpoena power, because that's the best scenario that we can possibly have, because that makes it mainstream. That introduces real evidence into the investigation, not the controlled stuff by Philip Zelikow. And that's how you're going to get to the truth. But the microcosm of the 9/11 truth movement is that everybody's worried about their own theories. And so they're protecting their own theories as opposed to insisting upon a new investigation. And so without unity, the message isn't heard, and it's easy to pick apart these groups from the mainstream media.
And then why in the world do people get so attached to their theories about what they think probably happened? I mean, I don't understand that. You know, who cares? I mean, at a certain point, it's important to me, for example, that people face up to the evidence for controlled demolition. But at the same time, I don't have a problem with people, like Dan Hopsicker, who he's very much in denial about demolition, and he just won't go there with that and certain other aspects of the case. But at the same time, he's done terrific work at what he does. And as long as people like that I have a difference with don't come after me, I'm going to be in their corner supporting them at every step along the way. But there seem to be folks out there who haven't figured that out, who think that the real issue is fighting the other 9/11 truthers about what probably really happened. And I just don't understand the appeal of that.
I absolutely agree. When I first started doing research that changed what the book that I was going to write was, my book, The Shell Game, was originally going to be about the big rollover, which is what happens after we run out of oil. And it wasn't until I read Michael C. Rupert's book, Crossing the Rubicon, that I really became exposed to the truth about 9/11. And Rupert was the investigator who exposed the war games and the FBI investigations. It's a tremendous, tremendous book. And I realized that if I could take elements of this and weave it into my story and other elements of other things that I had read too about 9/11, then I could give it, I could allow the American public, whether Republican or Democrat, to have digestible bites of the truth, because, this is a very emotional issue, and for a vast majority of Americans out there, they can't conceive of the fact that our own president would be behind something so heinous as this type of crime. And we are talking not just treason, but murder. And so, you know, I felt a fictional thriller, something that was entertaining as well as informative, would be an interesting way to get the information across. And I've received thousands and thousands of letters from people, including a lot of Republicans who have been forced to rethink things and will not be voting Republican. And so the book did accomplish what it set out to do. But again, with the 9/11 truth movement, you know, they're so concerned, some of these groups, not all of them, but a lot of these groups are so concerned with, well, did you mention this? Because this is what we believe in. Did you mention that? Because this is what we believe in. You know, we don't believe that we're running out of oil, so we're not going to back the book. And we don't believe that, you know, this and this happened, so we're not going to back the book. Or you didn't mention the Israelis in this, so we're not going to back the book. But I'm not writing a book for the 9/11 truth movement. I'm writing the book for the mainstream America who buys novels and trying to introduce the truth to groups that normally had no idea what the 9/11 truth movement is even about. And so, you know, but for the people who read the book in the 9/11 truth movement, a lot of them have sent me emails, all positive. It's just a matter of getting people to read the book.
And read it all the way through.
That always helps.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's a good point, because the prologue of the book takes place in 2007, and it's a meeting between two neoconservatives in the Bush administration and who work for the intelligence community, and a colonel who serves in the army stationed in Iraq. And they basically discuss the fact that the war is not going well, that, you know, that our army is, you know, recycling troops, that suicide rates are up, and that the biggest concern that they have is that Iran will be able to enrich uranium within the next 5 years, and that could lead to suitcase nuclear bombs going off in major U.S. cities. And the neocons, their philosophy is, well, the best way to handle that is allow one to go off in a U.S. city, because that will give them the new Pearl Harbor, the next 9/11 they need to launch an invasion of Iran with chemical weapons, which will allow the you wipe out major populations while keeping that good old oil available to suck out of Iran. And so that's the prologue of the story. Now, some people only read that and said, well, he's talking about the neocons, you know, and what the neocons are saying. No, I'm writing a thriller. And when you write a thriller, you show what both sides think. You know, you just can't have the hero's viewpoint. You have to have everybody's viewpoint of what's going on, so it makes sense.
Right.
So, yeah, reading the whole book would help.
Yeah. I think you captured that neocon worldview quite well and made it, you know, fairly plausible. I think that's really important to be able to do that. When I give lectures on 9/11, I really try to convey the way that these perpetrators of 9/11 could see the world, because, you know, people have this notion that, well, nobody would do that. And in fact, I argue that many, many thousands of people at the top of the military and foreign policy apparatus would realize that 9/11 was a very, very good strategic move, or at least seemed like it. You know, had the potential to be a new, Pearl Harbor was what mobilized the U.S. for war, had immense strategic value, and so it would be obvious to everyone at the top of the apparatus that something like 9/11 would promise to be a terrific strategic move, a real coup, and certainly some of those people would be more than willing to support it, given that their job is to sacrifice lives on this great chessboard. That's what they do. They're used to it. So being able to realize that mindset exists and get a taste of it is really important for understanding what happened. And I think the Shell Game does a good job at that, as well as at many other things. This is Kevin Barrett. I'm talking with Steve Alton, author of The Shell Game. And we'll be back for some more after the break. I believe Steve will be held over. We may have another guest by the time coming on, so you better stay tuned and find out. All right, take care. We'll be back in just a moment. Just give us a tune. We'll be right back.
The Bill of Rights protects every American's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now that right is being seriously undermined as legally registered rifles are being confiscated in some parts of our country. If we're not careful, we may find ourselves with no right to own guns. And that's where Gun Owners of America comes in. Gun Owners of America is in Washington every day fighting for you to keep that right. Congressman Ron Paul has called GOA the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington. You need to be part of this great grassroots group of activists who are keeping the heat on their members of Congress. Find out right now how you can join. Call 888-886-GUNS and get started receiving their fact-filled newsletters and action alerts. Call 888-886-GUNS or go to their webpage at gunowners.org and help make your voice heard in Washington. Make that call right now and call Gun Owners of America at 888-886-GUNS. Remember, it's not just about gun control, it's about control.
We the People, We the People Radio Network. Educational, inspirational, constitutional.